Into the turn, Buckaroo maintains the lead and now leads a length and a half, but J.O. Toman is being sent up to challenge now. It's J.O. Toman drawing alongside Buckaroo, and those two are heads apart on the turn. A gap of four lengths, and here's Alidar. He's moving too, and Alidar comes like a shot into third.
Welcome to Crawl Space. I'm Tim, here today with Lance. Lance, how are you today?
I'm doing fantastic today. Thank you so much for asking. I hope that everyone listening, hope they're doing as fantastic as well. And I'm very excited to introduce a brand new topic. This is, I think, a special episode for our listeners. It is true crime, but it's in a category that we haven't covered yet. And Tim, there's a category here that's empty for me, and that's your mood. How are you?
I'm doing great. Thanks a lot for asking. And yeah, our guest today was a guy that we met at CrimeCon. His name is Fred M. Cray. He wrote this book called Broken: The Suspicious Death of Alidar and the End of Horse Racing's Golden Age. And you can get that at his site, fredmcray.com. That's Cray with a K. Or it's on Amazon as well. You can order it there. There's even an audiobook version. But Lance, it's about horse murder. And it is, as you said, true crime. In some ways, I feel like it might be more disturbing than some of the other stories that we cover that are about human murder. How do you feel about that?
That's definitely something I agree with, because you have this animal that has done nothing to anybody except perform to the best of its capabilities and excel, and is loved by a lot of people and is just sort of a pure being. You don't have that with humans for the most part. We're all very flawed, and that's wonderful, but to hear what can be done to a living thing that, again, is at the height of its excellence and for profit is like nauseating. And there's graphic descriptions in here about theories of how this could have been done to Alidar. Just wanted to give a warning there, but I think you're right. I think you're right on the nose with that.
Okay, so take caution when listening and make sure to pick up a copy of Broken, Fred's book about Alidar. And we hope you really enjoy this conversation.
And Tim, if people wanted to hear this conversation without the commercial breaks, as one might, where could they listen to it, plus all of the other episodes that we've ever released in our lives without the commercials?
Well, our listening friends can now subscribe to Crawlspace Premium on Apple Podcasts. But if you're not an Apple user, you can go to crawlspace.supportingcast.fm and sign up for the same product there. You get early releases, ad-free episodes, and our bonus show that everybody loves.
All right, and we're going to break for one of those commercials right now, and we'll be right back with Fred M. Cray and the story of Alidar.
How's it going, everyone? It's Tim and Lance here. Have you ever wanted someone to read you creepy bedtime stories in the most velvety voice ever?
Well, you had me hooked at velvety, Tim. We are excited to share a podcast that is exactly that. It's called Nighty Night Bedtime Stories to Keep You Awake. And Tim, it's narrated by a friend of ours.
That's right. New York Times bestselling author and podcaster Rabia Chaudhry. Nighty Night is an anthology featuring classic horror stories this season and fictionalized true life stories in season one that are so creepy that you will realize reality is scarier than fiction.
And Tim, I know our favorite part of each episode is at the end when Rabia says, but wait, there's more to the story. And we get to hear those fascinating details about the author and the context of the tale. What's your favorite episode?
My favorite episode is The Tiny Hares from season one, which takes us on a harrowing journey when the narrator runs into a dangerous man in the woods. What about you?
Well, mine comes from the current season. It's called The Horla, in which we witness the protagonist spiral into a descent of madness. Tim, I feel like I'm constantly spiraling into a descent of madness, so I really relate to that one.
Well, I hear that. So dim your lights, get under a cozy blanket, and find and subscribe to Nighty Night wherever you get your podcasts.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Nighty Night, everyone.
Thanks to our sponsors, and now we're back to the program. Welcome to the podcast, Fred M. Cray. How are you today?
Well, I'm great. I'm a little bit tired from moving, but other than that, Everything's wonderful.
You said to pardon the chaos behind you. And actually, when you first came on, I looked behind you and I thought to myself, what a neat looking kitchen that was. There's absolutely no chaos behind you. But moving is never fun. And we really do appreciate you coming on to chat with us so soon from moving. You said you moved like 4 days ago.
Yeah, we've been here 4 days. It's like, you know, 40 in the morning and goes up to 70. The dogs love it. They're out back running around. I love to see them play.
Where are you broadcasting from right now?
Memphis, Tennessee. The land of Elvis and Graceland and Stax Records and Isaac Hayes. There's a lot of history here.
You mentioned your dogs. You're obviously an animal lover. How many dogs you got?
Six.
Six. All right. We met you recently at CrimeCon 2023 in Orlando, Florida, just, 6 weeks or so ago. And you approached us and gave us this card, and it is your book, Broken. Your approach was one of the more unique approaches, I would say, of anyone who had a product or some kind of project, because you were talking about animal crime. Yeah, tell us a little bit about how you first heard of this story.
Well, it all started when I moved to Gainesville. When I was in law school, I worked at the track in the summer in Lincoln, Nebraska. When you do that, you know, you get to see the backside of horse racing. Not the people who, you know, run the horses, but the people who take care of them. The grooms, the exercise riders, the hot walkers, you know, all these people that are behind the scenes. When you see a race, you see 2 minutes. It's exciting. You know, like any other event, there's a lot of preparation that you don't see. So I got to know all that stuff and I got to meet the horses, you know, in the barn, and I fell in love with horses in general. In 1978, I went to Miami to practice law. I passed the bar in 77 and I immediately got a job as a trial lawyer, and it was very difficult. I felt overwhelmed, and one weekend I decided to go see the horse races, the Flamingo Stakes at Hialeah Park. And in that race was a horse called Aladar. I hadn't known much of him before that. He ran his race and he was a kind of a come from behind horse. Watching him in the determined way that he came down the stretch and passed the pack, I felt like it was a personal message to me to say, look, you know, you can do this job. You can be determined and stick with it and do that, you know, and you will succeed. So I felt a personal connection to him that really you couldn't explain when you're one person in the stands watching a horse race. I liked him so much, he raced again in the Florida Derby, so I went and saw him again, and he won that race also. He then ran in the Triple Crown races that year in 1978 against Affirmed in the Kentucky Derby, the Preakness, and the Belmont, and he came in second all three races. Although he was not winning those races, he was the more beloved horse because he was the underdog. That's his racing career. You asked anybody about him, that would be what he was known for, coming in second, the horse that almost won, you know. I succeeded in doing trial law. I did it for like 25 years, and then I got out of that and got into animal law. But when I moved to Gainesville, I decided I wanted to find the headstone of a very famous horse named Dr. Fager. He was very fast, one of the fastest horses to ever run. And while I was on a horse tour there, you know, I was talking to the tour lady and she said, hey, what's your favorite horse? And I said, Aladar. And she said, well, there's a lady here driving the other tour bus that was there when Aladar got hurt. And I'd heard he'd gotten hurt and had to be euthanized. So I went to the lady and I said, hey, were you there that night that he was injured? And she said, yeah. I said, you know, what happened? She said, well, everybody who was on that farm knows what really happened. And I said, well, you know, do you think the farm manager was involved? And she said, I think he aligned it. And I said, well, you know, I'm really interested in this. I'd like to talk to you about it. And she said, no. I said, well, why not? She said, because I'm afraid for my children and my life. And she was serious. This was not a joke to her. And I thought, it's been 35 years since this incident. What is behind that sentence? She wouldn't talk to me anymore. And we all pretended that nothing happened in the bus ever after that. But then I went home and I started scouring the internet, getting all the books. There's a book named Wild Ride, which was written about Calumet Farm, which is where Aladar was stalled. In that book, there were suggestions that the mafia had connections to Calumet Farm. And in fact, in my research, I found that one of the farms down in Ocala, which is where that tour was bought with drug money. And it happened to be a farm where the farm manager, whose name was J.T. Lundy, sent horses to be trained. It brought up in my mind that scene of The Godfather where the guy wakes up with the horse head in his bed and there's blood everywhere. When I investigated it further, I thought the mafia was not involved in this. It was really something that was interesting to hear in Wild Ride and made it a more saucy book, but it was not, had nothing to do with his death. As I investigated the death, it became clear to me that this was not an accident. I decided to do some research. I found out that there were two trials of the Night Watchman and J.T. Lundy in Houston. It's a former trial lawyer, so I went down to Houston and got, they appealed those cases, so that meant there'd be transcripts of all the trial testimony, so I was able to get that. And even after all that, I talked to the insurance investigators who okayed the payment of $41.5 million within months after Aladar was euthanized. And so the public perception was, look, if the insurance paid $41.5 million, that had to be a righteous investigation and it had to be an accident. And then what changed things was an article written by a guy named Bill Knack, who was Secretariat's biographer. He wrote an article about a guy named Tommy Burns, who killed 15 to 20 horses for the insurance money. That was what the article was about. But then in a side article, Bill Knack wrote an article called Questions About Aladar. And he questioned, you know, whether Aladar was killed for the insurance money or not. And he went into the insurance investigation, the financial condition of the farm, how much money they owed to creditors. And that started the public perception of, hey, from, gee, we're sorry that Aladar had, you know, an accident, to, hey, was this some kind of conspiracy? Was this a way for Calumet to pay off his creditors? And if so, how did that happen? So after I was able to get the pictures that were taken the night of Aladar's incident and interview the insurance adjuster who was there that very night and took pictures, which are on my website, I just couldn't believe that a horse could break his own leg at 10 o'clock at night alone in his stall and not leave any damage on the stall door or the stall wall. That cannon bone is designed to take 7,000 pounds of force. And the idea that a horse at 10 o'clock at night would just haul off and kick his stall door and leave no damage, as a lawyer, I just couldn't understand that. So I decided then to do an investigation where I went around and talked to anybody who would talk about it. I interviewed over 25 witnesses. Then I wrote a book about what I found, which is called Broken: The Suspicious Death of Aladar and the End of Horse Racing's Golden Age.
You said in the beginning that you were a former trial lawyer and then you became an animal lawyer.
Yes.
And I'd never heard that before, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners had never heard that aside from Charlie making the joke on Always Sunny in Philadelphia that he's into bird law. That's like a reoccurring joke, and I never thought that was a thing.
Well, it's interesting because everybody at CrimeCon asked me that. In 2016, I won the ABA's, you know, Animal Lawyer of the Year Award. And people say, but what does that mean? You know? So let me tell you what animal law is. Animal law is if you and your partner have a dog and you decide to break up, who gets the dog? That's animal law. Your dog gets loose and kills a cat, and the animal control wants to put your dog to death because that's what the law says. Then I would be the one that would come in and defend your dog from death. I've gotten a lot of dogs off death row, and all my clients were innocent. And there's my dog. There's my dog now saying he's innocent too.
Shout out.
Yeah, shout out. That's way more honorable than defending people, I think.
It is, because you do feel that animals do not have their own voice. And, you know, this animal law practice was really satisfying. You know, we had lawsuits where we sued people who were selling puppies from puppy mills. Then they would sell the dogs without having a doctor examine them, and the dog would have a defective heart. They would not want to refund the money, or they refund the money and say, we'll give you another dog. And by that time, you fell in love with the dog. Just so many different kinds of things that are involved. You really have to learn it. So many different kinds of law, constitutional law, due process. I once had a case where I had to retrieve a stolen Great Dane. Now, all the dogs to steal, you would think that would be the least likely. We had to hire policemen that were trained in the laws of deadly force because we had a subpoena to search the premises of the person who we believe stole the dog. And so we had to pay $4,000 because somebody could say, hey, you're coming into my house, I'm going to shoot you. And these guys have to know how to react to that. And it was very exciting. I would say it was the highlight of my animal law career in terms of excitement. We had a staging area. We had four police cars breaking into one house and four police cars breaking into the brother's house because we didn't know which house the dog was located. The police came in with sirens and lights at 10 o'clock at night on a Thursday. And I said to the guy, why are we doing this at 10 o'clock on Thursday? And he said, because everybody's home at 10 o'clock on Thursday. And so we pull up to the guy's house. You know, he comes out, this Rocky type guy with huge muscles, big guy says, hi, we're here, collect this Great Dane. And the guy says, well, there's no Great Dane here. And the policeman says, well, I'm sure that that's what you're going to say, but you realize we don't have to take your word for that. We have a battering ram here and we can break down every door in your house looking for this dog, or you can bring the dog out. He said, it's up to you. And so the guy brought the dog out. Another interesting, really interesting example is there are some towns that have laws against having a pit bull. And so you have a fireman who has no training in anything come to your house. So let's do something. And he sees a pit bull and he says, that's a pit bull. We're going to banish your dog from the neighborhood. And the first question you have to ask yourself is, okay, is there a valid scientific basis for looking at how a dog looks and predicting the correct breed? And the answer is no. You can have two purebred dogs and their kids look nothing like them. And so we had to hire a DNA expert from the University of California who he went and got the DNA from dogs that were purebred. And first of all, there's nothing, no such dog as pit bull. Pit bull is a generic term for three different breeds that constitute that type of dog. So when anybody says so they have a pit bull, that's really not correct. But in any case, he got the DNA from dogs. We did a photo lineup of dogs that had 100% DNA of a pit bull and looked nothing like pit bulls and showed them to this guy who identified the dog. He couldn't do it. And when he got to our dog that he identified, he said he didn't know. So that was the end of that case. But it was a very interesting case.
As long as we're telling the stories about how you got involved with this, you have a really amusing story that's on your website about how you, I guess, defended yourself at a...
Yes. It really is how I got involved in animal law, why I got involved in animal law. And at the time that this happened, I had quit my job and I was really depressed and really in bad mental health. And so I got a ticket that said my dog was not licensed and therefore I was being fined. But my dog had died before the license was due. I called animal control. I said, listen, I'm telling you, my dog was not alive. And they said, well, look, you're going to have to come to trial. The trial is like, you know, 20 miles from my house was real inconvenience. But being a trial lawyer, I mean, I really relished the opportunity to go to trial. So I went down to the courthouse down there. And first thing you do, when I didn't dress as a lawyer, you get treated differently. They expect you to know more and they're harder on you. Most people don't like lawyers unless they need one. I went there in regular clothes and, you know, I asked the bailiff, I said, hey, you know, what's it like here? He said, man, nobody wins in this court. He said, there was a lady in here whose dog died 2 days after the license was due and they fined her anyway and she went out of here in tears. I thought, wow, that's rough, you know. So they call the case. The judge says, okay, do you guys want to, you know, try to agree? I said, no, I'm ready to go. So the animal control guy's on a computer and he says, look, you know, you had a dog. His license was due on such and such a date. You didn't get a license and therefore you owe, you know, $100. And the judge says, well, you know, what do you have to say about that? I said, well, I'd like to ask him a few questions. So I said, listen, you've never met me. You've never been to my house. You're looking at the computer. You have no firsthand personal information about anything that you've testified to. It's all on your computer. If somebody put something wrong in there, you just be reading something wrong. And I said, well, judge, I said, I reached into a bag that I brought with me and I said, here are my dog's ashes. You can see they're hermetically sealed. The date that the dog died and the date that he was cremated are on those ashes. My dog died before the license was due. And the judge turned to the guy and he laughed and he said, he's got you there. And all the audience, because there was like a 50 to 100 people just rooming around to get called, burst into applause. And the animal control officer was just so angry. For number one, you know, he was kind of humiliated in front of his friend, the judge, who's with him all day. And then all the people in the audience, you know, and he said, okay, well, we're going to appeal. And he grabbed the ashes and I guess he went to go copy the top. He said, you could have forged that, you know, and I thought, this is ridiculous. He says, we're going to appeal. And I lean over to the judge and I said, listen, just between you and me, you know, I'm a lawyer and I'm a trial lawyer. And I said, there's nothing to appeal. He has hearsay. And I have facts and I've testified to them. And if you were to appeal this, it would be affirmed every single time. And the judge looked at me and he said, you know, he's not going to appeal. He's just mad because he lost. And when I got home that night, I thought, you know what? This is no way to run animal control. You know, we pay animal control to make animals safer, to, you know, to give them licenses, to control dangerous dogs and stuff like that. And I the whole attitude of this was, I'm going to get you. And throughout my animal law career, I found that was true in the sense that if you get into animal control, if they have a reason and you go, look, you know, this is reasonable, you should let my dog go or whatever. If they're in court, they want to win. That's their goal. It's not what's fair. It's what it's governed by. Human beings, you know, it's a game and they want to win. So I came across that a lot in my animal practice. You know, I've had cases where, you know, a dog was arrested for being a dangerous dog and the statute said that while you're waiting for the hearing, the dog is supposed to stay at home. Well, animal control kept it at the pound. And I said, listen, you know, you're violating your own law. And they said, tough. That's what we're doing. So I had to file a writ of replevin, which is something that you file to get possession of your dog. It's an accelerated process. So the day before the hearing, the county attorney calls me and says, okay, they don't want to be embarrassed in front of the judge to say, well, we're not following our own procedures. So then, you know, you get it back. But, you know, that's all unnecessary. A lot of people find themselves in that situation and they don't know what to do. And many people cannot afford a lawyer to defend their dog. I didn't make a lot of money at it, but man, was it a lot of great results. And it informed this book and it informed my wanting to take Aladar's life and give him a legacy of what happened to him and what a great racing career he had. Paint a picture of the people around him who loved him, his grooms, his exercise rider, his trainer, all these people. When I talked to them, I mean, you could tell in their voice, they really loved this horse. And some of the stories that they told about him when he met the Queen of England, you know, there's some great stories in the book about his personality. And he did everything he was supposed to do. I wanted to say he was more than just a second place finisher in the 78 Triple Crown. He was a courageous horse who gave every race his 100% and was one of the greatest breeding stallions in the United States.
We'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsor.
And a thank you to our sponsors. Back to the program.
They come to the head of the stretch. J.O. Tobin on the outside. Buckaroo and Aladar stays on the rail and he gets through. It's Aladar along the inside who comes to the front. Aladar opening three in mid-stretch. Buckaroo, J.O. Tobin fading and True Statement beginning to gain. Through the stretch, Aladar draws clear by 7 lengths.
Okay, so how long was his racing career?
Well, his racing career started in 77. He raced in 78 as a three-year-old, and then he raced a couple more years, but he never regained his form. He eventually had an injury to his foot, and he was retired. But 78 was the height of his career.
And so it wasn't until 1990 that he was euthanized.
Well, he was injured, and then because of the injury, he had to be euthanized. In 1990, he was the most prolific breeding stallion in the United States, and he was breeding over 100 times at, you know, between $100,000 and $150,000 per time. So the night of November 13th, 1990, the night watchman comes to his stall and finds out he has a broken cannon bone, which is the bone between the knee and ankle. And, you know, they call in the vets, they call in the insurance adjusters, and, you know, they decide, well, the context of this, if you think about what I just said, is here's a horse that's breeding 100 times a year, making $150,000 per cover. He's making so much money. Why would there be any incentive for someone to kill this horse? It has to be an accident. When you go looking for an accident in an investigation, that's what you're going to find. They found that. The insurance paid, and it wasn't until 2 years later when Bill Knack said, now, wait a minute. Let's look at the financials. Let's ask some vets about these x-rays. Let's talk about it. After that, the bank that had loaned Calumet money went under. The FDIC took it over. And then the FBI came in, went out to the farm to find out who was Aladar, because Aladar was collateral for all these loans, and what happened to him. And when they started to go out and ask questions of the night watchman and the insurance investigator, they found out a lot of contradictory facts and some very circumstantial facts that nobody really knew. And so I'll give you two that will right away raise your suspicions. The night that Aladar was injured, the regular night watchman was not on duty. And a week before Aladar was injured, the regular night watchman was approached by someone in the Calumet Crown Vic. Somebody affiliated with Calumet got out and told the night watchman, listen, we think you're burned out and you need to take a vacation. You need to take a night off. And the guy said, look, I don't want to take a night off. And they basically said, well, you're taking the night off. He understood it to be a command, you know, not a request. So he said, okay, well, what night do you want me to take off? They said, next Tuesday. And that's the night Aladar was injured. So they had a substitute night watchman there that night who obviously would not notice. It would take him longer to do his rounds. That's the first question. And of course, that was never brought up in the initial insurance investigation. The second thing they found out was that there were two investigators that went. And the second investigator was called the night after Aladar was injured and told to go to Calumet and take pictures of the stall. So he goes there at 9 o'clock in the morning, and Calumet will not let him in on the premises. So he goes back to his boss. His boss says, listen, we've got a $5 million policy. You need to be let in. If you're not, we're not going to pay. So he calls Calumet and the insurance agent, and they agree to have let him in. And so when he gets in, it's 2 o'clock. And when he gets to the stall has been fixed and all the evidence has been thrown out. And so all he can do is take pictures of the stall door that's been repaired. And the question is, how could that happen? How could you have a $41.5 million claim, allow all the evidence to be thrown out? And what we find out subsequent to that is that Calumet's farm manager or farm secretary instructed at 9 o'clock that morning the farm maintenance man to fix the stall door and did not tell him to save anything or anything like that. So the second investigator had a lot of doubts about this case and whether it was an accident based on those two things, the substitute nice watchman and not being let on. And so that started now these questions about how could that this be an accident?
How is it that he was insured for $41.5 million? Is that a large amount for a horse to be insured?
It is. It is. It's a huge amount. I don't know if it's the biggest amount that's ever been paid, but at that time, back in 1990, that was the largest insurance payout, I think, that had ever been made. But Aldar was making a lot of money. Do the math 100 times 150, 100,000. And if he got hurt, people wanted to be paid for that if it was an accident. It's a way of hedging their bets. And there were also people who had breeding rights. So in other words, to complicate matters, there were people who paid $1 million, let's say, or $2 million to be able to breed a horse to Aldar every year. And so they also bought insurance so that if Aldar died, they wouldn't lose their $1 million or $2 million that they paid in advance for his breeding rights. So he was worth more than that if you did the numbers. The other interesting thing is that Calumet had not paid their insurance premiums for the time period where Aldar was injured, and yet the insurance company paid the claims anyway. Can you imagine not paying your car payment, your car insurance, and then having an accident and going, hey, you should pay my claim and then I'll pay you afterwards? That would never happen. So the answer to that is apparently in the horse business, you know, it's agrarian culture and you don't get paid until your tobacco gets, you know, out of the ground and dried. And so that was part of the thing that they allowed to happen. But there was also in my investigation a lot of questions about how insurance companies investigated claims, why they paid this claim so quickly, and how very prestigious farms got special treatment.
Can you explain the injury a little bit more in detail? And is this a type of injury that is common? And how does this type of injury happen?
Yeah, that's a good question. And it's the first question I had. I think it's the first question everybody has. You know, to break a cannon bone like this by kicking a stall door. The way this accident, the mechanism of the accident happening is a very evolving thing. The night it happened, everybody said he kicked the stall door and broke his leg. And in fact, when Bill Knack wrote his article 2 years later, that's what he thought happened. The veterinarians, you know, when you ask them what they say, well, you know, we said he kicked through the stall door, but it wasn't until 2 years later that Dr. Bramley said, well, what I meant when I said that was that he kicked the stall door, his hoof got outside between the stall door, his hoof got caught out there. So like it's a Chinese finger puzzle. So your hoof is outside the stall door closes. Now you're pulling your hoof and you can't get it in. And as you fight, you twist and you break it. The veterinarians, as the story evolved, went from saying he kicked through the stall door to saying that he twisted his foot and that was what broke it. And yet the insurance adjuster, Tom Dixon, in his report to Lloyd's, never says anything about the horse getting his hoof twisted. He says he just kicked that door the wrong way once too many times. That was another problem with the case was, you know, trying to figure out the mechanism of injury. It's not a common injury. No horseman that I talked to believed that this horse kicked the stall door and broke his leg. None of them had ever heard of it. John Beach, who was the trainer of Aldar, you know, brought up the point that this stall door was there since Calumet was built. You know, it was 30 or 40 years old, weighed 300 pounds. If you're going to kick that door, you'd have to leave a mark on the door. Or if you want to look at the pictures that were taken that night and all the reports that Tom Dixon wrote, what you will find is that Lloyd's of London paid this claim on the theory that Aldar kicked the stall door and that's it. But when it went to trial, the theory was that he got his foot caught and twisted. I mean, I looked at every newspaper clipping, every article that was ever written, the news press releases from Calumet, all the statements made by the vets. You know, and I even asked Dr. Bramlage, who was the one who testified about this twisting of the hoof. You know, when did he first say that? You know, did he tell some of the newspaper guys that? And it's hard to pin down. Nobody who was a horseman thought that you could kick the stall door that way. And nobody thought you could get your foot caught. Because if you got your foot caught, how would it ever get back inside the door? You know, in other words, it's once the stall door that weighs 300 pounds come down and traps your hoof, it's 5 inches. And the other thing is there was no damage to above the hoof and to the ankle where he'd be rubbing it all up against the, in between the stall wall and door. It would be raw. And it wasn't. The evidence that was called upon to say that this is what happened is that there's a bracket on the floor that has two bolts in it that got broken off. It had a roller on it, and it's hard to explain, but if you look at the pictures, you could see that. I don't know if you've ever seen a barn door on a house where it has two hinges that roll on the top. And then at the bottom, there's a piece that holds the door from going outward. That was broken. Those two bolts were broken. But we found out from the guy who fixed the door that those bolts were the size of a pencil because they were rusted. And so that was really a red herring.
We will be referencing people back to your website because you do have all the pictures there, and the picture of the roller bracket is pretty clear.
The other thing is if you look at the pictures, you see all these marks on the inside of Aladar's door. And that's what the insurance investigator said. Well, that's proof that Aladar kicked his door. But in the court trial, everybody said, and all the people that I interviewed said, those are not rear hoof marks. Those are Aladar's front hoof marks where he would kick. And the other thing is that door is, you know, that stall housed 4 or 5 other stallions, including Tim Tam, who won the Kentucky Derby. So there's no way of knowing what marks Aladar might or might not have made. The groom, who was Aladar's groom the night before the incident happened and the morning after, was clear that there were no new marks on the door that weren't already there from an alleged kicking of the door.
And we'll be right back after a quick word from our sponsors.
Thanks to our sponsors, and now we're back to the program.
So if this was somebody who was perpetrating this crime, how does a human being do this to a horse?
What I did was I interviewed, you remember I told you there was an article written about a guy who killed 15 to 20 horses for the insurance money. His name is Tommy Burns. His story is now on Netflix on a series called Bad Sports. His episode is called The Horse Hitman. And I interviewed him in person and brought with me all of the pictures that we had from Aladar's stall and from Tom Dixon and everything, and had him discuss, you know, how this could have been done in an intentional way. There were also some other opinions about how it could have been done. So John Ward, who took over Calumet after J.T. Lundy quit, he was the trainer of Monarcos, who won the Kentucky Derby also. His idea was that somebody would get Aladar's hoof, and where the stall opens and closes, they would put his hoof outside and then close the door on it. In other words, it would be the same thing that Dr. Bramlage said, but it would be on the side that opens and closes. And so you would have the ability to pull his hoof out, put his hoof outside the where the door closes, and then hold the door closed. The reason I don't think that would it happen that way is that John Ward said it would take 5 to 10 minutes for that horse to struggle and then break that leg. You don't have 5 to 10 minutes to wait around and see if the White Night Watchman's coming. It is an interesting theory. The most likely theory was Tommy Burns' theory, which is that you would come inside the stall, put a blanket over his eyes, you'd secure him with a lip shank or a twitch, and then you would back him out as if you were backing him out to breed. And as soon as that right hoof was exposed, you'd hit it with a baseball bat or a crowbar. You would let the horse go back in and you'd just get out of there and leave. And that's important because Tommy Burns actually did break a horse's leg with a crowbar. He didn't hold the crowbar. Another guy did. But then the horse got loose and ran, you know, he ran all around on it. How do you explain a horse breaking his leg and now he's out of his stall? Tommy is of the opinion that if he did this, he would have gone in, he would have kicked the roller bracket off of with his pencil point steel bolts, kicked that off, broken the leg with a crowbar, and then gotten out of there. And then when the insurance adjusters came, they would have seen this roller bracket out on the floor and said, ah, that's how it happened. That would have been, and it was the explanation.
That's disturbing.
It is disturbing.
Did Aladar have to be put down after the injury?
You have to understand that a broken cannon bone in a horse is 99% mortal to a horse. So when you break a cannon bone, you expect the horse to be euthanized. There have been horses that have broken their legs and they've tried to fix them. Ruffian was one. Barbaro was one. The problem is that part of the bone has a very low blood supply, and if the bone breaks through the skin, it gets infected, and it's usually fatal. In Aladar's case, the farm manager asked that they try to do heroic surgery. The insurance adjuster said they would have done heroic surgery anyway because the horse deserved any chance to live. And so they put together his bone with pins and plates. But unfortunately, the next day, he fell and broke his femur. And as a result of that, they had to euthanize. Many people say, well, you know, if the farm manager was involved, why would he want to do heroic surgery? And the answer is it would have been done anyway because the insurance company was in charge because they had all that money that was theirs to pay. They were in charge of Aladar's, all the decisions about Aladar's health and welfare. And they would have done it just, you know, because they thought that that was the only thing they could do is try their best. They could be no worse off in trying to do it. And so, you know, the interesting mystery about this is who would have had a motive and why would they have done it? That's a very complicated thing to unpack. And I think the book comes out with a very surprising conclusion, given what all the rumors were about how this happened, because there were a lot of rumors right after this happened about who did it and why. When you follow the money, it leads to a different conclusion than the rumors that were circulating after he was put down and all of the media attention given to Calumet's financial condition, which was dire.
They owed a lot of money to lenders?
Yeah, they owed $50 million to one bank. The financial condition is important because it wasn't just any one thing. So 2 weeks before Aladar died, Golden Eagle wrote a letter to Calumet saying, we're not going to renew our $5 million insurance policy in December, which means if they don't do something before December, they'll lose that $5 million. The state of Kentucky filed over $1 million tax lien on Calumet in the weeks before. Calumet missed its interest payment to First City Bank that it owed $50 million to. They had to borrow money from the bank to pay the insurance premiums on the horse that were late. When John Ward took over Calumet, there was nothing else that anybody knew that meant that Calumet was in dire financial condition. Only the insiders knew this. You know, all these debts and all the insurance and everything else were not known, but J.T. Lundy knew, the CFO knew, the guy from First City knew. The only asset they had that they could turn into money was this insurance policy. When John Ward took over, he said that no bills had been paid by Calumet for 1990 other than the electric and the water, and they had to get a bridge loan to pay the employees. Now, this is a farm with a history of having two Triple Crown winners and eight Kentucky Derby winners. I mean, this was with a premier farm, Calumet Farm, in the 50s and 60s. It was just inconceivable to people that they were that in debt. They ended up declaring bankruptcy, Calumet, about 6 to 8 months after Aladar passed away.
How did they get themselves so in debt?
This is part of the story, is that J.T. Lundy was a guy who planned to marry into the family that owned Calumet so he could take it over. He told his friends that's what he wanted to do, and he married a woman named Cindy Markey, who was, you know, one of the heirs. There were four heirs, and Lundy was the son-in-law, and he was the only one who knew about horses. So they gave him a 10-year contract in 1980, and he spent hundreds of millions of dollars. For example, there were two horses that he bought, Secreto and Magombo. He paid between $30 and $50 million for those two horses, and none of those horses ever brought in any money. They had no breeding potential. He had rented jets and bought jets to jet set around everywhere to Europe and Australia, where he would, you know, look at horses. The bottom line is that he spent the money. He had the track resurfaced three times. He rebuilt the mansion. He did all these. He spent it all, is what it amounts to. And at the end, when John Ward took over, he thought maybe Calumet was $50, $60 million in debt because he knew of First City National Bank of Houston's $50 million loan. But by the time they got into bankruptcy, the number was $120 million. J.T. Lundy's defense was, well, the heirs wanted me to bring Calumet back to, you know, the dominance it had in the 50s and 60s, and I had to spend a lot of money to do that. But everyone who looked at the bankruptcy record said, how could you spend all this money on all this ancillary stuff that had nothing to do really with horse racing?
On your site, there is a book references page. You come with quite a lot of research for this book. It's actually absurdly long. It's 50 pages long.
I decided, and the publisher decided, to put them on the website instead of putting them in the book, because how many people want to go and read 50 pages of citations? I have five boxes of paperwork for this book, between the newspaper articles, the interviews, the trial transcripts. Just the newspaper articles alone are a huge binder, and to put them in, you know, chronological order. It's a fascinating thing to do, to take all these disparate you know, things and put them all on a timeline and see how it comes out. That's what you do as a lawyer when you have a case. And inevitably, when you do that, you find links to things that you otherwise wouldn't find. You find out, oh, you know, this happened the day before this. Oh, that's pretty interesting. You know, you start to see, you know, how this all is connected. You know, on the website, you'll see there's a memo from 1988 that the CFO writes saying, you know, we're in trouble. Calumet was, was staying alive by making deals. That's what they were hoping to do. They were trying to sell Calumet to the Japanese. It never happened, but that's what they were hoping.
Is this kind of insurance fraud a common thing?
It's not unusual. So when I interviewed Tommy Burns, he talked about killing 15 to 20 horses. There are three pages in my book where I enumerate horses that are known to have been killed for the insurance money and how it was done. Anytime you have a horse that has a value that is in excess of what the fair market, you know, what the owner thinks that let's say he bought it for $50,000 and now, you know, he doesn't think it's worth $50,000 and he insured it for $50,000, he can pay somebody to have it done. It's an awful thing. It was so much of a problem that there's a law review article written on how to prevent horses from being killed for the insurance fraud. And, you know, I cited it in one of the citations, but, you know, it has a catalog of horses that have been killed with ping pong balls, suffocation with, you know, bags over their heads, electrocution, starting the barns on fire. I mean, it's just awful, 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 awful. You know, I love seeing horses run. That's what drew me to horse racing, but I'm very disturbed about where horse racing is now. I don't know if I can continue to support what's going on now in terms of horse racing, because I think they're not taking care of the welfare of the horses enough after they race. You know, I don't think they're taking care of them enough before they race. I think they should be scanning them to see if, you know, if their legs are sturdy enough to withstand a 2-minute run at full speed. But there've been too many deaths, too many suspensions for drug use and that kind of thing that it's just the sport is in a dark place right now. I have a special feeling about horses because, to me, horses dragged us out of the dark ages on their backs with plowing and delivering the mail and fighting in wars they knew nothing about. And we owe them a debt. This kind of stewardship is, we should be giving them the best, and we're not doing it.